My name is Vinay Shaw, and I'm a member of Al-Anon.
Hi,
Vinay. Hi, y'all. I came into this magnificent program February the 7th of 1969 in Lubbock, Texas. The county of Lubbock, I call it Lubbock County all the time, and Lubbock County is about as big as this room, and or it was when I was first came in this fellowship. I want to thank Shirley and the committee for having me. This is a real treat. This is the second time I've been in Oregon. Was in Roseburg. The last fall, I believe it was, my first trip over here, and it's just magnificent. I'm sorry. I'm doing the best I can. They said there's no PA system tonight. Some of y'all screwed that up this afternoon before I got here. And I just don't project well. I'm sorry. If you'll wave your hand from time to time, I'll try to remember to speak up. And you should have gotten here earlier and got a front seat.
We'll have it in the morning.
Okay. I'm going to speak a language that we can all understand. You may not understand my accent. Some people have trouble with it up here. Y'all talk a little bit funnier than I do. And some people from time to time don't know some of the expressions I use and some of the words, so you're just on your own. I have a Texas friend here from El Paso. She can help you. The language I'm going to speak of is my fellowship language. I know no other. I'll use no words except Al-Anon words. I'll have no experience except Al-Anon experience. So I think we all should be able to understand each other. I speak another language, I hope, language of the heart. And if I get out of that, we're all in trouble. I am not a professional, nothing. I'm just an Al-Anon that's been here and worked a long time. And I'm not any different than anybody sitting in this room. I would assume the reason I've been asked here is just simply because I've done it a little bit longer than y'all. That's probably the only difference. I don't do anything different particularly, except I don't do what I used to do as long, and I don't do it near as often. And that kind of does it. I don't get paid for doing this. You all paid my plane ticket here, and you'll pay my plane ticket back, hopefully. And and that's it. I'm just one of us. I love the way we start off in this program when the first step, the first word is we. And that's what I do. It's a we. It's a we thing. I want to tell you a little bit about who I am tonight. And then the only thing I know that works for me, that has ever worked for me, is the tools of this program. And that's what I'm going to talk about all weekend. It's the tools of the program that's helped me get where I'm at and doing what I do. As I told you, I think some of you think I'm from California. I am not. I'm sleeping out there, but I'm from Texas. And my family is Baptist. I don't know if y'all know what that means up here, but that's almost a disease in its own self. And I am not a Baptist. They were Baptist and tried to tell me Baptist things, but Baptist things sounded very boring to me. You couldn't do nothing, especially dance. And Jiminy Crickets, that's what I learned to do real, real quick. I have a mama and a daddy, neither of whom have a problem with alcoholism. However, it's all in my family. I have uncles and aunts and grandfathers and grandparents and everybody that you can think of as you come on down, the disease has been there. I think it's very interesting what I've heard over the news lately. I suppose y'all have too. It's been all the news and the newspaper. They cut the heads open of a bunch of dead alcoholics and looked in there and found a gene. And they called it, I think, the pleasure-seeking behavior gene. Now, isn't that a word? Yeah, there's some of those pleasure-seeking dudes I would have helped them open the brain out to take a look at. Don't you think it'd be fun if they opened up Al-Anon's brains and saw what was crawling around in there? I mean, as long back as I remember, I was chasing the pleasure-seeking behavior gentleman. I found them in my own pleasure-seeking in a place called the West Texas Honky Tonk, which is absolutely magnificent. I'm sorry that some of you here have experienced those, and they're just wonderful. I think y'all had a meeting earlier that I missed because I was flying in, and so I'm kind of behind it. And just for my own, just cause, how many Al-Anons are here in the room? Yay! How many AAs are in the room? Yay! How exciting! Y'all are the ones I'll hang out with. I think Al-Anons are boring overall. How many of you, this is your very first conference ever in Al-Anon, or AA, or any place? Yeah, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, great. You're in such an experience. One of the things that I found out when I got here is that there's power in this very room. You're going to find so much healing going on this weekend in this very room. And this room didn't have much power until we walked in. When everybody sat down here, we've all got the power. I just think that's the most amazing thing. Because some of you don't look like you got much power. Nothing. I think some of you been here all night, hadn't you? Yeah. I didn't know I had power when I walked in here. I absolutely didn't know. But inside of me was a God already there just waiting for me to acknowledge it. And I didn't even know that. When I got here, I was married to a practicing alcoholic. I had 2 children. And I came to Al-Anon because of that practicing alcoholic, hoping to get him sober, hoping I'd get all right, hoping the madness would stop at my house. There was just total madness there. Now, this poor old guy didn't have anything to do with the madness of my own. Nothing. I just chased him, till I caught him. He didn't have nothing to do with my disease. He had nothing to do with making me an Al-Anon. I did not marry a sweet little young guy looking for college and going off, and I was out looking for the drunks way before I even knew that's what I was looking for. I have a personality that needs alcoholic personality. I'm just hooked on them like I am sugar, and chocolate. Mm-hmm. There's something about them that fixes some things in me. We just kind of fit like a glove. I discovered that I have some Al-Anon-isms. Alcoholics have alcoholism, and I have discovered through my own inventories, through listening to some of your inventories, through just sitting and listening to meetings like this, that we have personalities that are quite alike. We come from different places, from different backgrounds, but we have a lot of them. Shirley was talking about relationships. My relationship started when I was a little kid and didn't even know that's what it was. And up until this day, I'm not real sure that this is a relationship problem. I just love it. When I just love the words that we can come up with. Mercy. Like meaningful relationships. we just call it shacked up when I was, back in the day. And I wanted to be married, but you don't tell anybody you want to be married. Isn't that dumb? I mean, you just want to be married. That's the whole scheme of life, is you're a little kid and you play with little dolls, and that's going to be your baby someday, and you play, house. I had a lot of fun playing house. I don't know about y'all, but I got into some fun stuff playing house, playing married. And, from the get-go, we want to be married. And then we play like we don't want to be. And it's just the dumbest thing in the world, I think, some of the stuff we do ourselves. I had these isms, I guess, from right out of the chute. I'm addicted to excitement. I love excitement. I'm a nurturing person. I take care of. I am a controlling person. I need to control. I think it's wonderful when we learn that we can't control the alcoholic, so we come in and we get to be GRs. I have this thing about me that's so magnificent. I mean, it's just the most magnificent thing. I always know best. In any situation, I always know best. And if you'll just give me 3 or 4 minutes, you know, I'll explain to you how you can straighten up your whole life. G and I were talking about it on the way up here today, you know. I just know what everybody should be doing on any given day. I can give you directions of how you should walk, talk, sit, act, not act, what to say to him, what not to say to him, how to be a mother, how to be a wife. Yeah, I can just do that. Now, I have noticed that nobody really seems to care. I've been blessed like this. I have this thing called denial. I mean, absolute total denial. I mean, there's things go on that I say and that I do that I have no more idea of than the man in the moon. There is things that went on in my life forever that I had no idea. It is a protective thing I discovered. As long as I'm in denial, I don't have to do anything about anything. I just keep on doing what I'm doing. And if I keep on doing what I'm doing, I keep on getting what I'm getting. Real simple. I have this thing that's, I don't know why I've got this one, but it's this martyr syndrome. I mean, just, God, you know, that's dumb to be a martyr. I mean, it's really, I mean, it's dumb, but I, you know, it's like, will you please take the trash out? No, they won't, so it's, you know, never mind! I'll do it myself! Why do I do that? I don't know, you know, it's just, get off your dead butt and get the trash out. I'm busy, but I won't do that, you know, I do it. Don't know that one. I have this, there is something in me that to this very day, I mean like the day before yesterday, fights being wrong. God, I don't want to be wrong. If I'm wrong, that makes you right. And I do not want to tell him he's right about anything, any day of the week. He kind of, you know, gets with it and reminds you over and over and over. The 10th step was probably the hardest one I've ever had to do. I don't like to be wrong. I like to be right on top of things and know how to do it. I have to blame. I mean, if he didn't, I wouldn't. If they hadn't have, I wouldn't have. If you could, I couldn't. You know, it's just what I do. I just blame. And complain. Oh, mercy. If you just knew what I really have to put up with. If you just knew that, you would understand why I'm such a mess. Which, of course, leads into, I have this thing that needs self-pity. You can tell me just about anything. You can say, Vinoy, you're having resentment today. And I say, yeah, I probably am. You can say, Vinoy, you're angry today. Yeah, that's true. Vinoy, you're feeling fear today. Yeah, I really am. Vinoy, you're feeling self-pity today. How dare you tell me I'm feeling sorry for myself? Isn't that strange? Don't y'all do that? I don't know why that is. I'll take any character defect that you name and work with it except self-pity. Don't tell me I'm feeling sorry for myself. That's fighting words. And I don't know where I got that. I have no earthly idea. So you put all this stuff plus some others, and you get that in me, and you get me out in life. Now, I come from a family that did the very best they could. My brother broke his neck at a real young age. I was real young. I had 3 brothers, Mom and Daddy. And Daddy had a little business. He went broke trying to take care of my brother. So we're broke, and I grew up many, many years in just poverty. Several of those years, I was put out with some friends and an aunt and uncle to keep me. I'd stay here a while, and stay there a while, and stay here a while, because my family was trying to put things together, and they was trying to take care of my brother, who was in a hospital in a different state. So I felt unnecessary. I felt in the way. And I was. You know, I was in the way. But they were kind and they were gracious to me. And they never made me feel that I was imposing. But I just was, I didn't belong in those families. And I took that right in here in my soul, and I kept it for a long, long time. When we did get back together and everything kind of started trying to put things together, my house, our home, it smelled like a hospital. It had bad smells in it. I don't know, for some reason, you know, the smells get to me. There was a smell of rotting flesh in my home. There was smell of urine, stale urine in my home. There was a lot of silence in my home. I didn't invite people over to my house. It was not a pleasant place to be. It was silence except for the occasional explosions of my parents, who just exploded from time to time due to the stress and strain that they were under. Seeing my daddy go broke was not a fun thing. My family's religion came to their aid, and I was this little kid, and I see these Christians coming. And I think most Christians all look alike. You know, all alcoholics look alike. You know. Christians look alike. They have gray hair, silver looking, and they have... And they all love peach cobbler and apple pie. And they pull up in front of the house, and they're bringing in their peach cobblers and their apple pie, and they all have this silver little gray hair and their purple lips, and they're all plump, and they all smell like roses. And they come up, and they hug you, and they tell you Jesus loves you, and you're just smothered in these big old boobs. And I'll turn around, try to escape, and I see my mother sit down on the couch and start crying. And I see my daddy go out in the backyard with this real funny look on his face. And in my head as a kid, all this is very negative. What they've done is they brought in sacks and sacks and sacks of groceries. They brought us food. And evidently it's hard on my father's ego. Evidently my mother was so in gratitude that she was crying, but I didn't know that was what's going on. So I made the decision that the Christian folks and Jesus was not any part of my life. And I don't know, I don't know. But that was it. The only time I went to church thereafter was with a girlfriend that I ran around with, and her mama made her get up and leave, go to church. And when it was Easter and you could buy a new dress. I always got a new dress on Easter. We just had Easter, and I had a bunch of people at my house, and after we just kind of sitting around, laying around the floor, and I asked everybody in the room, tell me your favorite Easter. And so many of them couldn't remember. I can remember Easters just about year after year after year. And when everybody left, I really got to think about that. Me and a friend of mine was talking about it. Two reasons, I think. Number one, I'm in the zoo. California's the zoo. If you're from California, God love you. And BJ, I'm so glad you escaped. But there are some really different lifestyles in California. And one of them is they're not Baptist out there. They did not come from the Southern Baptist belt like I did. And Easter and Christmas is it. And it's very heavy on the religious part. But bigger than that is an Easter dress. I always got an Easter dress. It was the one time a year I got an Easter dress and a pair of shoes. Guaranteed. So listen, I know about Easters. So here I am with this kind of religious background, and I've got all these isms, and I find the honky-tonk, and I'm tall, and I'm skinny, I have no personality, and I walk in, and here's a smorgasbord of drunks, excitement, God, people who, you know, they're just about to fall off the stool, and I can run over and catch them and nurture them and take care of them, yeah, what a blessing, you know, what a blessing. I have heard over and over and over and over alcoholics describe their first drink, describe what it did to them. And I knew exactly the feeling they was talking about. It took me a long time to figure out what that feeling was. Alcoholics say this from behind this podium. When they take a drink, they're tall and skinny like I was, and no personality like I was, fearful like I was. They don't know how to face the world like I didn't. They go in, they find a drink. They take that drink, and it goes down. All that warm feeling hits their stomach, and it just explodes. It goes boom, explodes, and they just feel it coming out, just tingling, and they just makes them feel just right. Now, haven't you all heard them say that over and over and over? And I just knew I knew that, but I couldn't exactly figure it out until one time it dawned on me. I'm in the honky-tonk. It's closing time. The lights are low. The excitement are on. I just got one almost falling off a stool. We're out there on that dance floor. We're whirling. twirling, and it's just beautiful, and the music's just right. You know, it's one of those belly-rubbing ones, and he's he's right here in this ear, and he's nuzzling, and he's just telling me all the cutest things you ever heard. And all of a sudden, he reaches down and whispers, "Baby, I need you." Everything in me comes alive, and I take this wonderful God-loving mister home with me, and I find the things that I've been looking for so long, I don't even know what I'm looking for. He holds me in his arms. There's a human being holding me in their arms, and I've never experienced this that I know of, except playing house when I was a kid. My folks didn't hold me. My folks didn't hug me. My folks were hard-working, busy people that didn't know how to do that. I was never told that I remember out loud by my folks, "I love you." I don't remember hearing that from anybody. It just didn't happen, and most of you didn't hear that either. We just didn't in our disease that we all wound up in this very room. So here's someone holding me in their skin, touching skin, and it's warm, and it's alive. And I absolutely did not know that's what I was looking for. And I guarantee you, I sold my soul to get that feeling. I sold everything that I'd been taught. I stripped myself of all the dignity that a lady can strip herself for to hear those words and to feel that feeling. And they'd say, "I love you." And God, what a marvelous thing that was, and the feelings and the emotions and the trauma and the, God, I loved it. And the next morning, they'd be gone. And then that stuff would hit me again. And I know one more time what I've known over and over and over. There's just something a little wrong with me. There's something that I know that gets proven over and over and over. And it's that I'm unlovable. And I don't know how that happened. I have no earthly idea what's left out of me. What happened to me as a kid? What can I do now to fix it? There's this thing inside my soul, inside my gut, that I can't be loved. I'll never know what it's like to be loved. And that's just the saddest damn feeling in this world. It's a terrible thing to live with that. It always comes over me in big, huge waves right after you turn the light out at night and you're in bed, whether you're with somebody or whether you ain't. It's the saddest time for me is when I turn that light off and I'm laying there that instant before sleep or the instant before I toss and turn all night. It's a terrible feeling. And I carried it with me for many, many years. I get in those honky-tonks and I do all the things that we do to get our dignity stripped, and I'm from one man to another man. And I meet this first major alcoholic. He's a gangster. And I didn't know that. I become pregnant by him. We're living together. Meaningful relationship. I have this child, and he doesn't want the responsibility of me and this child, so he kicks me out. I'm hurt. I'm rejected. So what do? I do the only thing I know to do is manipulate, control, fix, hurt, get back, jab, punch, do whatever you can do. And I flaunted myself in front of him that he didn't like. And the result of that is one night he took a shotgun and blew this man's head off. So I have a little girl whose daddy's a murderer, and I've got a man's life on my conscience. And a man going to penitentiary, a young man, too, all of them young. We were all young. What a horrible thing. It just drove me further down in my disease. It drove me further down to knowing exactly who and what I was. It was a piece of garbage. Just garbage. With no way out. And the only thing I could think of was to get a different hymn. God, you know, a hymn's where all this is going to fix me. So I get out of that crap. I was at a place called the Bloody Bucket. I mean, I was the lower companions that other people were seeking, you know. So I did what you're supposed to do. I got a different hymn. I went over to the rodeo ground. I figured I'd get somebody over there. It'd be all bloodied, red American cowboy. For God's sakes, how can you go wrong doing that?
So I got one. And we whirled around that dance floor, and it was closing time. It was midnight, and he got right here, and he whispered, and off we was running. And somehow or another, I captured this one. I captured him the same way that I had lived and the way I was continuing to live till I got this program. He punched me in the chest one night, and I belted him over the head with an empty quart beer bottle, just busted all over. We dug glass out of that man. And when he came back over in a few minutes, he looked at me and said, "I think you just knocked some sense into me. I think we ought to get married." Of course we should, and we did. And it was an absolutely fantastic marriage for the first 6 days. And then we're off and running. We're doing the same things that everybody in this room has done and knows real well. He's in the progression of his alcoholism. I'm in the progression of my Al-Anonisms, and down we go. Off we're running. There's violence. There's awful, awful violence in my home. I started, he started. It was just terrible. You never knew in the middle of the night what was going to come out my windows or my door at my house. Neighbors looked at us funny. I never looked up when I walked in out of my doors because I didn't know what the neighbors was thinking or what they'd seen. Any given day, you could see my clothes in the street or his clothes in the street or my clothes on top of the car or whatever. It was just a terrible place. I had black eyes, busted lips. I've been shot at. I've been stabbed. I've been pistol whipped. I've been thrown out of cars and doors. You know, I just treated myself so ungodly. I don't even know how I'm alive except by the grace of a very loving God. Why we put ourselves through that, I don't know. I discovered after I got here, there was a lot of things. I felt so guilty for who and what I was. I felt so guilty. I needed punished. So I lived in this punishment, in this absolute hell for so many years. I decided to keep this little cowboy home was to give him a boy, and I did. I had a little boy. And I was so thrilled for about 6 days. And then there he was. He's off and gone. And there's nothing that's going to fix this thing down here. Children don't fix it. Husbands don't fix it. Nothing fixes it. I'm unlovable. I know it. And look at him show the world because he's not here. And I'm unlovable. And we just keep on doing that thing one day at a time until I couldn't do it no more. Till I found y'all. And alcoholism is just ugly, isn't it? I mean, there's nothing ugly about it. One more time in my house was a smell of rotten flesh. One more time my house was the stale urine. One more time was the smell of blood from time to time. Burnt food. Stale trash that I didn't take out. Kids that was quiet and stayed in their room out of mama's way. Not out of the drunk's way, my way. A very silent house. Unless the explosion happened, the screaming and the yelling and the throwing and just the madness that we all know. And I tried everything that y'all tried. We all try to do something about that madness. You don't know if you're like I was. I didn't know what I was fighting. I had no idea what I was fighting. I didn't know what a resentment was. I didn't know, oh, you're in fear. Get a grip. I mean, he wasn't home. You know. And I did all. I'd leave. I'd come back. I'd hide. I just did everything. One Thursday, I had two black eyes, and this busted lip was up over my nose, and I couldn't eat. And I knew he was going to come home. He worked out of town Fridays, and he was coming home Thursday. And I knew I couldn't do another Friday. I couldn't do it. There wasn't nothing in me that could do that. Nothing. And I just didn't know what to do. I absolutely did not know what to do. I was as desperate and full of despair as anybody ever seen or heard of. I did not know how to breathe in. I didn't know how to breathe out. I just stopped. I didn't know what to do. I was through. I was absolutely, totally through. And what was the solution? I didn't have any earthly idea. And for some reason, I don't know why, but for some reason, I got up and I picked up the phone. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous in the Yellow Pages. And this man called, and I told him that I needed to see about stopping someone's drinking, and he gave me another telephone number, and this lady came over, and called. And I talked to her, and she said, "Come over," and I went over to her house. Now, I didn't go to anybody's house. I didn't go anywhere. I didn't get out of my house. I didn't do nothing. I just kind of sat there. And here I am going to a total stranger's lady's house. She opened the door, and she took me through her house. And do you know what I remember? I think it's so funny, if everybody had time to tell exactly what they first remembered, you'd hear the darndest stuff. Because this is what I remember. We walked through her living room, through the kitchen, into the den. As I walked through the kitchen, I looked in the kitchen sink, I looked on the cabinets, I looked on the table, and I thought, I wonder where her dishes are. Isn't that strange? And she talked to me, and her husband came in a little bit, and he talked to me. And before long, I agreed to go to a meeting, and they took me to a meeting. And I walked into a room, much like this very room. And things was going on just like there was tonight, this afternoon, last night, whatever y'all got here. If you're a newcomer, how many of you are here with a year or less? Anybody? Yeah. Great. It is so awesome here. It's so awesome to see and hear. Laughter. Jiminy Cricket laughing. That's the first thing I heard when they opened the doors to the A Club. I opened the door and walked in, and these two guys were laughing, and I just stood there and just stopped and was listening. They were laughing. And the man and the woman had to kind of gently push me on in. I hadn't heard that in so long. I hadn't cried in so long. I hadn't talked in so long. I hadn't yelled in so long. I hadn't done nothing. I just sat in a chair. And when we get here in this room, God, look what's happened already. I mean, you've insulted each other. You've hugged each other. You've lied to each other. You said, I'm fine. Some of you have already cried with each other, and some of you have prayed already for each other. It's in this room. In this very room is the most powerful thing on earth, known to man. And I didn't even know it when I walked in. Didn't have the slightest idea what was going to change my life. Just not a thing. And I want you to know my life has changed. That was 21 years ago. And I am absolutely not that person. And that person died a very slow death. And I was reborn. Y'all have taught me absolutely everything that I am tonight. Y'all taught me. You taught me how to talk. I don't talk trash anymore. Occasionally, but I don't talk trash anymore. You taught me to be a lady. I mean a lady. I was telling Judy, I am so uncomfortable tonight, I just can't tell you how uncomfortable I am. I have on jeans. I don't do that. As far as I know, this is my very first time in history of getting behind a podium and speaking without a dress on. And I'm sure it doesn't matter to y'all. It matters to me. It matters to me. I was told by my sponsor to present the very best of me that I can while I'm in front of you, because this minute, this is all I'm going on up here. And I should be dressed the very finest I've got for you all, because y'all taught me how to do that. And I apologize. I don't know where I was at. I was thinking about freezing and rain, and I've got boots, I've got coats, I've got sweaters, I've got socks, I've got long handles, I have everything but my two skirts. And I really apologize. That makes me feel real bad, newcomers. And if you're here and you're behind the podium, I suggest that you always dress the very best. It wouldn't matter to me if we was out here in a rock pile. It doesn't matter to me that we're out in a forest. It matters to me that I tell you how sincerely I love you. And I want to show you how sincerely I love you. God, you give me everything I am. Everything. You taught me how to dress. You taught me how to act. You taught me how to... One lady taught me how to use a knife and fork properly. Now, if you think that isn't going somewhere. You taught me everything. You taught me about a God of my own understanding. You taught me how to be a friend. You taught me how to be a wife, a mother, a daughter. God, every one of you taught me that. Some of you taught me what to do. Some of you taught me what not to do by watching you. You've made everything of me that I am today in this very room, sharing the way we're going to share all weekend. What a marvelous thing. It's absolutely, totally, for free. It's for fun. It's because it makes me feel better. If you think I come up here to impress y'all, you're crazy. I came up here to tell y'all, thank you. I came up here to tell y'all, I need you. I need to be here. I need to be talking. I need to be doing these things. I just come through one of the worst years I've had in a long, long time in this program. God, I need you. I need to be doing this. I need to be reminded of what a miracle I am, because I am a miracle. There's nothing I've done. I've come to this very room, and you've given it to me. I've come here, and you've shared who and what you are. And you've changed my life. Because you've changed my life, there's so many people around me that are really grateful, too. Like my mama, my kids, my husband. I want to share with you rest of the weekend my journey in this fellowship. It is magnificent. I got the favorite story of all stories that I've ever heard. It's mine. I love it. Because you told me what you did, and I put it inside my little gut, and I churned with it, and I fixed it, and I changed it, and then I come back and ask you how you did it again, and I put it all together. It's going to come out the way it comes out this weekend. It's going to come out, I hope, the way it was given to me. I hope that I don't add anything of my magnificent mind to it. I hope that I just give you a program that was exactly the way it was given to me. I hope I don't change nothing, because I see and I hear so much in our fellowship that's being changed, it just scares the hell out of me. And I do not ever want to screw up anything in this fellowship. I'm not going to tell you anything new and wonderful. I have no psychobabble to give you. I have Al-Anon to give you. I have 12 steps to give you. And if there's one thing that I would ask you when I leave here, is you give it away exactly the way you give it. Don't start nothing new. Don't add nothing to this fellowship. We don't need you. We don't need your I know best syndrome. Let's do it the way it was given to us. Let's keep it exactly the way we found it. Let's do it the only way I know to do it. Let me share with you my 12 steps this weekend. Let me share with you the experience that I had working them and what it's done for me and what I'm like today, as the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells us to do. If you'll let me do that, it'll be a thrill, it'll be a pleasure, and it'll be something I really need. Thank you, Charlotte.
This is the end of session one, the start of session two.
Lord, she's crazy. Good morning, everybody. My name is Benoit Shaw, and I'm a member of Al-Anon.
Hi.
I understand that there's a microphone coming, so if you can hear, just hang on. She's not back yet. Because I can't talk real loud. I do the best I can, but that's it. So hopefully we're going to have one, and it should be on its way. This should turn out to be an extremely interesting weekend. There's no shower. There's no toilet. Shirley and a few others don't even have toothbrushes. Sure glad y'all invited me up here. I mean, if it... does anybody have a program to tell me when I'm supposed to hush? 10:30? Thank you. Thanks. When Shirley first called me, and when she sent me a tentative outline, she said that she would like the theme of this weekend to be step into relationships, I think. Is that what it is? Yeah. And I thought about that when she said it to me, and I said, well, you know, of course, that's what we do here. We step right into them, and how we step into them is the 12 steps of our program. Thank you, dear. I found something. You know, we're always talking about relationships, aren't we? I mean, it's just, that seems to be what makes the world go round, is relationships. And when you say relationships to me, I'm always thinking about the hen and the shin, you know. That's what a relationship means to me, until I got in here and figured out that relationships meant a whole lot of different things. And my relationships with everybody in my life, and where they've come from, And I saw this not too long ago, and it just really blew me away, about relationships. It says steps 8 and 9 are concerned with relationships. First, we took a look backward and tried to discover where we had been at fault. Next, we make a vigorous attempt to repair the damage we have done. And third, having thus cleaned away the debris of the past, we consider how, with our newfound knowledge of ourselves, we may develop the very best possible relations with every human being that we know. This is a very large order. It is a task which we may perform with increasing skill, but never really finish. Learning how to live in the greatest peace, partnership, and brotherhood and our sisterhood with all men and women of whatever description is a moving and a fascinating adventure. And I, of course, indeed have found that so in my life. It's very moving to be with all of you in this very room. It's a very moving thing. It certainly is an adventure. And so has my years in this program. And the way I got the best possible relationship with every human being that I know today is through the 12 steps of our program. That's the only thing that's ever worked for me. I've done other things, but the only thing that's ever worked for me is the 12 steps of this program, meetings, a sponsorship, and staying within the traditions. That's what works for me. It keeps my life just right, just exactly right, and it's wonderful. Unfortunately, the last several years, and it's just been, I don't know, maybe 10 years, 15 years, some of you that's been around longer can probably help me remember, but the first 5 years, or 6 or 7 years I was in the program, we studied and did our steps out of the experts where they got it, and that was the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous in the AA's 12 and 12. And after about 5 or 6 years, somehow or another, somebody started saying, well, excuse me, we had a conference and we voted on conference approved literature, and somehow or another, the Big Book was not discussed or just kind of left out. So a couple of years later, the two-year wanderers that got into the program started saying, excuse me, that's not on this list we have here. And I thought, you know, well, that's, oh, okay. And we didn't think a thing in the world about it. We just said, oh, okay. And this is my opinion. This is my experience. It is not up for debate. I don't debate it. So when I get down, this, you know, this is my time behind this podium. You'll have your time and you can do whatever you want to. But my experience has come from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous in the 12 and 12. And the Al-Anon's 12 and 12 years later as it came about. And the One Day at a Time book. That's all we had. We didn't have the Al-Anon's 12 and 12 when I first came in for years. So my experience is that, and I cannot change it, and that's what I'm going to share with you. Also, my friend Arbutus, some of you I'm sure know Arbutus. If you don't, you really are missing a treat. She's the warhorse of the South. has pointed out to many of us, and she was on the very first panel of our World Service Office. She's delegate number one from Texas. She was such a magnificent lady. They were broke. They had no money. She got on Greyhound buses and traveled all over Texas setting up what we now know as our conference. And what a magnificent lady. And she refuses to put any of her information in the archives till they say that she can put it in the Big Book because that's all she knows. And I just love her. She also pointed this out. This is our literature. The 12 steps and 12 traditions of Al-Anon. This has been opened and put down on a piece of paper and copied so you'll know what it is. This is the front and the back. And this is on the fifth tradition of Al-Anon. Fifth tradition, Al-Anon says, each Al-Anon family group has but one purpose. Now this I put into myself. All the traditions I have put into the I form since I've been here. After I was here a while, we went through them as a group and we put them in the I form. It changed my life. If you hadn't done that, do it. It's a great meeting. I have but one purpose, to help the families of alcoholics. I do this by practicing the 12 steps of AA myself, by encouraging and understanding our alcoholic relatives, and by welcoming and giving comfort to the families of alcoholics. That's the fifth tradition. I have a purpose. Isn't that neat? Just absolutely neat. It says in here,
We learn as much as possible about the illness of alcoholism by putting this knowledge into practice in our homes. Going to AA meeting gives us greater insight into the alcoholic's problems, as well as reading some of the basic texts on the subject, particularly the basic AA book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's in our literature. So just to let you know where I'm coming from, not to start an argument or anything else, this is Al-Anon literature, and this is why I do what I do. What I'd like to do is just, and I'm certainly not an expert, and I want that to be known for those of you who are new. Thank you very much. For those of you who are new, I am not an expert. I want you to know that. This is just my experience. That's all it is. It's what I do and how I do these steps. And I'm just going to go through them with you, maybe tell a little bit, maybe not. It's just how I've done it. And I'd like to try to go through the first three steps this morning. And the first step says, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives have become unmanageable. If you're like I was when I first got here, I'm not powerless over anything, thanks. I'm in good control, perfect control. I know what to do, how to do. And I don't ask for help. I don't ever ask for help for anybody, from anybody, anytime. And to say to you that I don't know how is totally against every Al-Anon principle that there is. So I had to get to the place to know what powerlessness means. As I told you last night, as I believed that happened to me, I got to a point of surrender. I gave up trying to figure out a way to fix the alcoholic, and I thought if I fixed the alcoholic, I'd be okay. What I discovered was I couldn't fix him. I tried everything, all the things that all of us try to do to stop the alcoholic's drinking, and I got crazier and crazier and crazier and crazier. I was in despair when I got to this meeting. I was through. I had come to the point of being powerless, and I didn't even know it. I looked up the word power one time and powerlessness. I looked up surrender. I looked up defeat in our Al-Anon One Day at a Time book, and you know what's not in there? Surrender is not in the Al-Anon One Day at a Time book. You know the index at the back? Defeat's not there. Powerlessness is not there. It's not there. Isn't that amazing? What is there, I discovered, is acceptance. There's a whole bunch of pages on acceptance. I think the bathrooms have just come into the... I see buckets and mops and running back there. Interesting weekend. Something's unplugged anyway. Speaking of one day at a time, does somebody have one they can loan me for a minute? Thank you, baby. There was a man in my part of the country, his name was Bob White. Some of you have heard of him, and some of you have heard me talk about him. But he talks about power. He talks about it a lot in powerlessness. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, when they're describing alcoholism, it says lack of power was our dilemma. And the lack of power to do what is very interesting to me. Lack of power to do what? Lack of power to get him to do what I want him to, or to get them to do what I want them to do. That is the most helpless, powerless feeling that I know. Because you see, I know what they should do, and I try to explain it to them. And if that don't work, I try to explain it to them again. If that don't work, I explain it again. You know, and I spend a lot of my time explaining. And it's frustrating. It is absolutely so frustrating to know the correct answer, and nobody listened. God, it's just awful. And I just kept on and on and on and on, beating my head against this brick wall till I was a bloody pulp. Just done it. Black eyes, busted lips, trying to explain to him. And I was the one that always come out with black eyes and bloody lips. You'd think that it would dawn on me eventually that this don't work, but it didn't. And I had to be beat down. I had to, you know, let go like this, just all the way down. Total defeat. I had to admit total surrender before I could ever think, oh, I'm powerless. It never occurred to me that I was powerless because I didn't know what that meant. Power is energy. Power moves things. Power is something I can't even explain. I can't touch it. I can't feel it. It's power, and I don't know what it is. I don't even know how to use it. And I didn't have it. Lack of power was my dilemma. I found out after I come to y'all that I didn't have the power. And what a place to be. My life unmanageable? I mean, it just couldn't possibly be unmanageable. How could unmanageable be when I have to think? I mean, I'm thinking a lot. I think about the problem. I'm thinking how to manage it. I'm thinking about it at 11:30, at 12 a.m., at 2:30 a.m., at 3 a.m. as I'm watching the street and listening for his pickup. I'm thinking, how can I manage this? And I'm looking up down the street and everybody else in bed asleep. And I'm up managing. I get on the phone at 2:30 a.m. Have you seen him? I get the kids up. Get them in the car. Go find him. I'm scared to death I'm going to find him. But I'm going to go find him. What if I find him with a her? You know, what if the kids are sick? Well, give them a rag and a bucket. Let's go. You know, I got to manage. And you come here and you tell me my life's unmanageable? It just does not compute. And I have to listen to you and listen to you and listen to you. And I have to hear what you're saying. I have to watch your faces. I have to think. I have to go home and think about it. And finally, somewhere it comes in here that I am powerless over this, whatever this is. Because you can't tell me it's a disease. It takes me a long time to figure out alcoholism is a disease. You know, get a grip. He dresses up, he puts his cowboy hat on and his foo-foo juice, and he goes out to the honky-tonks dancing. That don't look sick to me, honey. That looks like he's going out to have a good time without moi. Disease, disease, disease. How do you figure that is? Well, I did what the fifth tradition told me to and what I was told to do. I started going to meetings, open meetings of AA. Pretty quick after I came in the program, I just discovered there, listening to sober alcoholics about the disease. I read the big book of alcoholics like my sponsor told me to. We read the doctor's description of an alcoholic. We studied it. There was things in there that really impressed me, like an alcoholic is in full flight from reality. Now think about that. They're in full flight from reality. And I'm up at 2:30 a.m. chasing them. They drink to fix this thing here. I'm chasing them to fix this thing in here. I'm trying to fix this thing in my gut, and I don't know what it is. I'm trying to fix it. And I realize that everything I've tried my entire life to fix this ain't fixing it. And that is powerlessness. That is surrender. Their book says that they quit fighting anything or anyone anymore. Quit fighting anything. Anything. Does that mean I quit fighting him going out? Does that mean I quit explaining to him? Does that mean I quit chasing him? Does that mean I quit hitting him over the head with a bottle when he comes in? Does that mean I can go to bed and sleep? God, spiritual experience to me after I come in this program was getting a full night's sleep. Going to bed and going to sleep. Is that a miracle? I didn't have to stand at the window. It didn't make him come home.
It didn't do anything. I got to go to bed and go to sleep. What a concept. Whoa. I listened to sober alcoholics talk about how god-awful they felt about their families. How the look on their wives' face broke their heart. And yet they took another drink as they was looking at them. Did y'all watch the movie of Bill Wilson's life? Do you know the saddest part in that? I just could not believe it. When he was standing at the window and he was telling Lois all these things, how alcohol just makes him crazy and how he just, it tears his whole life up and just all the things, all the degrading things that he did. And he turned to her, and I don't remember exactly how he said it, but he said, "And yet I want another drink so bad I can hardly stand it." Now, if I hadn't heard those things, I would never have looked at this husband of mine and figured out what was going on in his life. I just would not have understood that. They go through hell that I don't understand. I don't understand the craving that an alcoholic goes through. I have no earthly idea. All I know is that I was standing over them screaming, "If you loved me, you'd put that ball down." And they're standing there. Of course they love, or they think they love, or they don't know how to love, and they don't know how to put that bottle down. So both of us are fighting something that neither one of us know the slightest thing about. And the madness that's in that, the sadness that's in that, is almost unspeakable, isn't it? And these little kids, I kick out of my way. "Get out of the way, I gotta get the window. You know, get out of my way. Go play, don't bother me. If you're hungry, go get a peanut butter sandwich. Leave me the hell alone. I got to sit here and think. I'm busy. And I get here and I hear sober alcoholics talk about their disease. And it starts to come to me, my God, this man has a disease. He really doesn't want to do these things. Because John said the other night that he did what he's doing tonight and he didn't mean to. Jack said 2 years ago he did such and such and my husband did that last night and he didn't mean to. And I started putting all those things together. And I read that book. I read the description of the alcoholic. And then somewhere deep inside of me, it started coming together little by little. And one Sunday afternoon, he said, "I'm going to go do such and such, and I'll be back in a minute." It was one of those rare weekends where we had a good weekend, when we had fun. You know, rare times when that's what sucked me back in, you know. Just sucked me back in. It's going to be okay, you know. And it was a wonderful weekend, and it was Sunday. God, we got through Friday and Saturday, and here it was Sunday. He said, "I'll be back shortly," and he left. And he didn't come back in until that night, and he was just staggering drunk when he walked in. And I remember he walked in, and he ducked his head for a second. He said, "I'm sorry." And he just had his head down, and then he came up. And when he came up, the fire was shooting, and all of a sudden, "If you hadn't done da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, I'd come home." And I thought, you know, that's the way it always started. And I just looked at him. And I didn't say a word. I just smiled at him. It occurred to me, I just saw alcoholism. I just saw it. He came in. He didn't want to leave, but he had something he had to do. He didn't intend to stay, but he couldn't help it. He came in drunk, and he didn't intend to be. He tried to tell him he was sorry, but he couldn't do that. He had to come back up with the defense of alcoholism. And then I accepted it. I'd heard y'all talk about it. I'd heard the AAs talk about it. But that day, I accepted it. And I admitted I was powerless over that. And the battle was over. I mean, the battle at that point in my life, for me, was over. I surrendered to his disease. I knew there was nothing I could do about that. And at that moment, and only at that moment, could I begin my own program. That's when I knew I had to work those steps for me. That's what y'all were talking about. And I went back to my meeting with a whole different attitude. A whole different attitude. Because when I first walked in, I wasn't quite sure about y'all. That couple that I told you about took me to my first meeting. And that sober alcoholic woman took me to the Al-Anon meeting. She'd never been to Al-Anon before, and she hadn't been since, as far as I know. But she took me in there. And y'all were talking about these things. But she slipped a word or two in that made me real uncomfortable. It was God. Oh, no, these are Christians. But there was something here that kept me, and what kept me was y'all talking about the drinking. That's what I was interested in, was the drinking, and I heard y'all talking about the drinking. That's all I heard at first. That's not all y'all talked about, but that's what I heard. So that kept me coming. When I admitted I was powerless and I knew that I had to do this thing is when I really got a sponsor. And she really started working with me. I was scared to death to get a sponsor. The woman that I was attracted to was seemed to be the most popular woman in the room, you know. She was the most busiest for sure. But she said things that I could understand. I could hear her. When I couldn't hear anybody else, I'd hear her. And I'd wait till it was her turn to talk. And I'd perk up. I just couldn't wait to hear her. And then I knew I was supposed to get a sponsor after I'd heard the rules around here. I'm real quick. I catch on what you're supposed to do. I knew I was supposed to get a sponsor, but oh God, how could I do that? I couldn't go up and ask somebody to be my sponsor. They'd say no. They'd be too busy. They wouldn't have time for me. And who in the hell did I think I was to ask somebody to sponsor me? I didn't want to take direction anyway. And God is a pretty neat God. You know, even with us who are crazier and goons, he just works things out. And I kept coming long enough, and they were watching me. And they left me alone long enough just for it to be right. And they caught me one night after the meeting was over. One went to one door, and one went to the other door. So that they'd catch me, because I always escaped. And I ran right into her. And she said a few things to me that only she could say, and only I could hear. And somehow or another, I don't remember when it was, week, days, whatever, I had the courage to mention sponsor to her. God, she was great. She was the most loving, kind thing for a little while. They can do it, can't they? And then it's when she got me on a program of action, and that's when she gave me the big book, and that's when we started studying these things, and that's when I started working the steps, and she was insistent about that. And we'd sit and we'd read and we'd talk and we'd think about these things and talk about them just for hours. We'd go to meetings after the meetings, you know. She'd say, come go to coffee. I'd say, I can't do that. He's home. And she'd say, is he going to be mad when you get home? Oh, yeah, he's going to be mad when I get home. Will he be mad if you're an hour later? Well, I guess he would be. So he's going to be mad if I went home in 5 minutes or an hour, so I decided to go for the hour. And it always turned out to be 2 or 3 hours. Pretty soon he wasn't home on that night anyway. You know, he was staying home every night except that night, and then he changed. He'd go somewhere except that night, and he was doing everything in this world except trying to support me and coming here, of course. So some of the things that we did was work these steps, and she gave me this book one day at a time and told me to read it. We didn't have the index back then. I am so sick. I didn't know that these things were going to be cherished someday, you know. I had a first edition I got rid of. Didn't know about it. I gave my very first Al-Anon book to a sick ex-sister-in-law of mine that never appreciated it anyway. Trying to help her and she won't be helped. One of the first things that my sponsor gave me to read out of this book is July 1st. And I've used it in all these years, over and over and over. Everybody I sponsor has to read July 1st right off the first thing out of the bat. Here he is. Listen to this. This I learned in Al-Anon, says a member at a meeting, that the man I married cannot be the source of my happiness. Now, I've changed that sentence a lot. I have changed it too. This I learned in Al-Anon. The daughter of mine cannot be my source of happiness. The son of mine cannot not be the source of my happiness. That sponsor of mine cannot be my source of happiness. My neighbor cannot be the source of my happiness. My checkbook cannot be the source of my happiness. My boss cannot be the source of my happiness. That witch that I work with cannot be the source of my happiness. This I learned in Al-Anon, says a member of the meeting, that the man I married cannot be the source of my happiness. The gift of life is personally mine, as his life belongs to him, to enjoy or destroy as each of us wish. I see him angry, must I be? He is hostile, must I be? Am I being faithless to my marriage vows when I achieve a bit of self-confidence while he continues to suffer the pains of self-doubt? I am not his guide, master, or keeper. We are individuals and must each find our lonely way to our goals. My sources of comfort and strength he refuses to share with me. I have learned through bitter experience that it is fruitless to offer them. Adjusting myself to things as they are and being able to love without trying to interfere with or control anyone else, however close to me, that is what I search for and can find in Al-Anon. The learning is sometimes painful. The reward is life itself, rich, full, and serene. If thou attend to thyself and to God, thou wilt be little moved by what thou perceivest outside of thee. I wish they'd change that last thing. Those thous and thees. My teeth are split in old age. It's hard to read this. There was another one that she gave me years later that I just don't think is the most, exciting one. But sometimes in an Al-Anon meeting, someone makes a casual remark that reaches into my consciousness and takes hold. It comes to mind again and again because it gave me a new way of looking at things. It might be a perfectly commonplace phrase, even a worn-out cliche that would have no significance until it appeared in a new context. Then it springs into life, and it brings a vital tool to understanding. Now, this is what I don't particularly like. This is what she had me read for 30 days once. One member explained how she finally got the Al-Anon idea. I just figured out that it all boils down to four words. Mind your own business. Is that disgusting or what? If it don't have my name on it, I'm not supposed to pick it up. Mind your own business. Admit that you're powerless. Admit that you surrender. Admit that you're defeated. Admit it. I may admit it, but I ain't going to tell you too quick. I'll slowly work into it, Just slowly work into it. But I'm powerless. I have ceased fighting anything or anyone anymore. And that's the way I try to live my life today, and I forget it. I really do forget it, and I have to be reminded by y'all all the time. I had to admit that I was powerless over my alcoholic. I had to admit that there was alcoholics in my life. I worked this step on my husband, and I worked it and I worked it on him. And I really let him go. I really understood I was powerless over him. I really let him live his own life. I worked the powerlessness over my alcoholic husband for 7 years. I was in Al-Anon and he was drinking. So if you're here today with living with a practicing alcoholic, I certainly do understand. And if he says he's going to leave, and if he does leave, don't worry, he'll be back. One of the hardest things I've ever in my life tried to get rid of is an alcoholic. If you're afraid he's going to die, if that just worries you to death and you just think about it all the time, quit thinking about it. But you should think about the sadness of he's going to live. That's the sad thing. They're not going to die. They live and they live and they live and they live in this dreaded disease. It's a dreaded disease, and they live in this horror. This absolute horror. And I learned to have compassion for this man by going to those open AA meetings and by reading the big book and studying it with my group and my friends and my babies. I learned compassion for this man and let him go. And after 7 years in this fellowship, we did get a divorce. There was a lot of violence in my life, as I told y'all, a lot of violence. It was just that way. My first major alcoholic beat me up. My second major alcoholic beat me up. It was just a lifestyle. When I got in this program, that stopped. By God's miracle, and by one of the alcoholics in the AA room told me one night when I was discussing a black eye, he said, "Why don't you try to keep your mouth shut and see what happens?" What a concept. I did, and it quit. But 7 years after I was going to this program, doing the things that I know to do, he came in one night extremely drunk and totally in a blackout, and I knew it. His eyes were as wild as I've ever seen anybody's wild eyes. And he flipped the light on, and he just jumped in that bed and just screaming mad and started beating me up. And I started crawling out of that bed, and I was trying to get away from him, and I got all caught up in the sheets, and I was tangled, and it made me fall, and I fell over the foot of the bed, and I landed on the carpet, and my cheek hit the carpet, and I kind of bounced, and I looked up, and there in the doorway was my two children. And they were screaming and dancing. My little son was just dancing like this. And it was, "Daddy, please don't hit her anymore. Please don't hit her anymore." And somehow or another, the scales of denial dropped at that instant. And I thought, my God, these kids. These kids. I wonder what they're living through. My God. Look at the pain on their faces. It so helped me, as God's my witness, I never thought about my children. I just never thought about them. I didn't think they heard it. I didn't think they saw it. I'd send them to their room. It was years and years in this program that I heard my daughter say, "My mama used to send us across the street when she knew there was going to be trouble. Told, went to sleep. I got up," said she, "and stood at the window and watched my house all night." I didn't know that was going on with my kids. I had no earthly idea. My son has never told me what went on with him. He doesn't say anything. He's real quiet. He's 22 years old. I don't know what goes on with him. I just didn't know. But that night I saw their face. And I left. We escaped. And I left. And I went to the only people that I know to go to, my sponsors. And before you could say anything, I was out, had a place of my own. It was the most God-awful place you've ever seen in your life. And we just absolutely loved it. I worked in a drugstore. It's the only kind of job I knew. I was a high school dropout, and I worked in a drugstore, and I got the posters, the advertisements that we had all over the drugstore. It was springtime, and they were Rexall was, you know, had Rexall, whatever it was. And there was cute little things in the posters. And I took them home, and we pasted them over the walls, made them decorations to hide the holes in the, you know, the wallpaper. And it was really turned out to be kind of cute little house. I think I paid $25 a month, as was. We kind of do like y'all did. You know, we had buckets and mops. And sometimes it smelled, sometimes it didn't. Oh, and it was glorious. It was absolutely glorious. And then probably the toughest powerlessness that I've ever done, the toughest, is when I ceased fighting my daughter. An alcoholic husband is one thing, because you can leave. When you have a child, that's something else. My daughter turned 15, and my word, stuff that she was doing. Slipping out the back door, lying to me, going people that I was appalled by, going places that I couldn't imagine. And the fight was on. I mean, the fight was on. I was going to make her be different. I was going to make this one happen. I am her mother. She will do as I say. Do you understand me? I don't know how many of you tried to keep an alcoholic teenager in their room.
We'll get out.
They kind of slither through the cracks, don't they? I mean, and when I go to my sponsor, tell her what's happening, tell her what's going on, screaming and yelling and carrying on, and absolutely a mad woman, my sponsor says to me, very gently, she was a neat lady, she knew when to, she just knew what to do all the time. Very gently, she said to me, "You need to surrender this. You need to realize that your daughter is an alcoholic." I wanted to slap her. My daughter was not an alcoholic. Get a grip. She was having teenage problems, and I could fix it. And very quietly, she says, "Your daughter is an alcoholic." Jeez. I didn't want my daughter to be an alcoholic. I did not want that to happen to my daughter. The thought of it. Because I knew where she was going, and she was 16 years old. And I thought, I got to stop this one. And she came in one night, and I beat her to a pulp. Just in my madness, my total madness, I just beat my daughter to a pulp. I had her down on the floor. I straddled her and just beaten her. I was out of my head. And she escaped me. There's a picture of her still today in Lubbock County, the welfare department. Her friends took her down there the next day and took a picture of her face so that she could put charges against me. And she chickened out and didn't. But it's there, and I remember that it's there. And the surrender happened. And I told my daughter, "You're going to have to leave here. I'm going to kill you. You're going to have to leave here. You're going to have to do whatever it is for you that you do." And I didn't release her with love. I can't release with love. I kicked her butt out. Because I was worn out. I give out. I was absolutely totally give out. I had done everything that I needed to do, and I couldn't handle that deal. I couldn't handle it. And she did as everybody does. She goes off and does her things. And I watched from afar. I watched alcoholism strip my daughter of her dignity. I watched her come by my house from time to time in jeans so tight that, you know, if she sneezed, it's going to bust out. In this scanty clothing and this just filth all over. You know, just, it was just a tragic thing for me. I really hated it. It broke my heart. And I loved her and I hated her at the very same time. I've always had this thing with her because when she was a little girl, her daddy was a murderer. I was so guilty with her anyway. I tried to do everything I could with her anyway to make things right with her, and I couldn't. And here she was, you know, I knew it was my fault. I knew it was my fault that she's an alcoholic. And I was in this program a long time. I knew if I'd just done something different, she wouldn't be an alcoholic. And here she was, this little child that just, it was pitiful. I remember one time my sister-in-law said to me, when my little girl was a little baby and she's laying in my lap, 3 or 4 months old, my sister-in-law said to me, "Some stuff is still tough, isn't it?" I don't care how long you've been around here, I'll be judged. My sister-in-law says to me, "I'll be so glad when your daughter learns your personality." I said, "What do you mean?" She says, "She's laying there smiling up at you and you're just looking at her. You're not smiling. You're just looking at her." And, you know, that's what I did all of her life. I just looked at her. I didn't know what to do. I did not know what to do. Nobody told me how to be a mama.